So we're, this series of talks, we're looking at, we're looking at the Dharma through symbols and stories. And for this bit of it, we're using this Sangharakshita system of spiritual development, or system of meditation, as a sort of structure. And the first part of that system of spiritual development is positive emotion, integration, or integration and positive emotion. They sort of go together. So integration is the first one, and we're looking at symbols, stories to do with integration. So integration meaning becoming a whole united being, not a divided being with lots of different conflicting goals and drives, one being, not a sort of bundle of arguing beings. Integration meaning having our full energies at our disposal, not having our energies in conflict, not having our energies sort of blocked and gone underground. So becoming a purposeful and powerful being who's got some energy to put behind things. And then also integration in the sense of being in touch with our heights and our depths, having a sense of our higher self, if you like, having a sense of our deep energies and motivations, our sort of deep intuition. So all of that, bringing all that together into a, to some degree, a unified being, is what we mean by integration. So the title of this evening is got to do with this idea of half human, half animal. And it's a really common theme in world mythology, isn't it? Beings, mythological beings that are half human, half animal. So we've got, for example, the satyr, or however you pronounce it, goat's feet, goat's lower body and man's upper body. Or we've got the sphinx, so the sphinx there in the desert, so a woman's head and lion's body. Or the centaur, which has got a powerful sort of man's upper body and head, and then the incredibly powerful body, lower body of a horse and four legs of a horse. Or the lesser known manticore, which is it's a man's head and a lion's body and sometimes a scorpion's tail. So it's sort of spanning several bits of the animal kingdom. So what I'm going to do tonight is look at what these symbols might be getting at. Look at what they might be getting at, how they might be related to this theme of integration. And bringing in moving on to some specifically Buddhist beasts. And seeing what they mean in the context of the Dharma. So, half human, half animal, okay? So something like a centaur. What do animals symbolise for us? So I think our attitude towards animals is a bit ambivalent. I mean, they seem to have two quite different meanings. On the one hand, animals are sort of low, they're coarse, they're not very intelligent, they're lacking in culture. There's that whole sort of quite a dark side to animals as far as we're concerned. Animals are lower creation. On the other hand, animals are incredibly beautiful. You know, we spend a lot of time perhaps looking at wildlife programs. They're amazingly beautiful, graceful, full of power and energy and a sort of sense of joy and grace. So there's both sides. Really, the animals are, you know, if we look at the animal kingdom, there's both sides there. And part of our nature, I think, is like that. We've got an animal inheritance. We share something like, somebody will correct me on this, 99.something% of our DNA with chimpanzees, and probably about 99% with tigers. I mean, it's like we've got an animal inheritance. 99.8 with chimpanzees. Yeah. So our sense of ourselves as being completely different. Well, you know. So we've got this animal inheritance. We've got a body. We've got the body of an animal. And this animal side of our, you know, we've definitely got it. We've got it, and it's got its own drives. And this animal side of our being, well, on the one hand, it might be a bit coarse and unspiritual. And we might think, ew, not very nice. But it's also full of power and energy. It's also a source of power and energy and joy. And part of this job, our job of becoming of integration, part of our job of becoming an integrated being, is to integrate that animal side of ourselves, to integrate that energy in a way that means it isn't just coarse or ignorant. It's not bound up purely with biological drives like food and aggression and sex. Because this energy is part of us. This energy is there and it's part of us. We need to be at home with it. We need to integrate it, use it, make it serve our higher nature, if you like. In order to come into our full power, if you like, as human beings, we need that energy. And of course, that's what, well, I mean, I think that's what these half-human, half-animal figures that are so common in world mythology are symbolizing. They're representing the full, powerful, integrated human being who has at least integrated those animal energies, if not the higher energies, who's not sort of separated there into sort of intellect and body. So it might take, you know, just looking at one of them, the idea of the satyr, the centaur. So upper head and body of a human. And traditionally the centaur is sort of a noble being, quite noble, strong, handsome, and then powered by this tremendously muscular horse's body. So there's this real sense of energy and power. Or the manticore or the sphinx, lion and human. So the wisdom of a human, the awareness of a human, but combined with that sort of latent power of a lion. Awesome, frightening, quiet but controlled, capable of bursting into powerful action. So I think that's what these symbols mean. And I think we maybe need to just sort of think about them a little bit, just pay a little bit of attention to them, because this integration of, if you like, those coarse energies that come along with our animal inheritance, is an essential part of the spiritual life. And it's perhaps a part of the spiritual life that we don't want to take on board. We don't sort of see it that way. There can be a tendency to see the spiritual life in purely in terms of developing sort of what one might call soft qualities like gentleness, compassion, kindness, patience, restraint. But we also need some of those more, well, initially maybe coarser or harder qualities like strength, determination, courage, robustness. We need the hard qualities to develop the soft ones. If we haven't got some strength and fortitude and ability to put up with dissatisfaction and discomfort, well, actually we'll be very vulnerable and we'll tend to be focused on ourselves a lot. We'll tend to be a bit precious about ourselves, have very little energy or strength to spare for others. It'll be very difficult for us to give ourselves to others because we'll be worried about ourselves. But there can be this strong tendency to think that spiritual development is all about the softer qualities and that a real Buddhist wouldn't say boo to a goose. We can sort of tend to think that we need to cut off our coarser energies. They're just not very nice. We need to cut them off, block them out, push them down, get them out of the way, repress them. We don't want any lively energies. No lively emotions that might be a bit challenging or inconvenient. And if we go that way, if we see the spiritual life in those terms, it can give rise to a really quite negative, life-denying approach to it. And it's a real, I think, another one of those near enemies of the spiritual life, the spiritual practice, all based on blocking our energies rather than expressing them in positive ways. If we try to practice that way, instead of becoming integrated, potent beings, we become pale and thin. I use the word etiolated. Etiolated, I'm a botanist by training. Etiolated is what happens to plants if you keep them in a cupboard. Yeah? They sort of go long and spindly and floppy and pale. And we can go long and spindly and floppy and pale if we haven't got a bit of robustness. We actually need lots of energy to get enlightened. We need all our energy to get enlightened. We can't afford to cut any of it off. We haven't got enough to start with. We can't afford to be cutting it off. If we do cut it off, what happens? One thing that might happen is, so we're going saying, well, no, I'm not angry. I'm a Buddhist. I don't do anger. No, I don't feel competitive. The fact that I had this uprush of resentment when, I don't do that. So if we're doing that, what tends to happen? One of the things that tends to happen is that these energies come out in other ways. They sort of go underground and they come out in other ways. They come out in the completely uncontrolled outburst that seems completely out of context days after some event that really got up our nose. Or they come out as... well, to everybody else, everything we do seems a little bit competitive, but we think we're not being competitive, for example. Or they come out just because we're not allowing ourselves to feel our feelings because we don't want to feel those negative feelings. We don't feel any of our feelings. So we're just flat and grey. And we don't, you know, the metta bhavana is this grey thing. We don't have warmth to go out to others. So, and we get depressed. We get depressed. We're sitting on this stuff, so we get depressed. So we can't do that. We can't treat the spiritual life as saying, no, I don't do that, I'm a Buddhist. Because those sort of emotions, those coarser energies, those coarser emotions are there. All of them, aggression, sexual energy, all of those energies. And we need to find a way to work with this sort of energy, to make friends with it, to coax it to a higher level. And ultimately to use it in the service of our higher purpose, our spiritual life. So, that sounds really dangerous, doesn't it? Say something like anger. Take something like anger and aggression. It's really violent. It's really dangerous. It can destroy relationships. We don't want to just express it unskillfully. But we don't want to cut off the energy that's tied up with it. So what do we do? What do we do? How do we actually practice in this area? Well, one key is awareness. And one key to developing awareness is meditation. So I'll talk a little bit about awareness and where that comes in, and then a little bit about meditation and where that comes in. So one key is awareness. The key is to be aware of, say, anger, if we're talking about anger or aggression, to be aware of it, but not ruled by it. To be able to stand a little bit above it. Okay, there is anger. I'm experiencing anger, but I have a choice. But I have a choice as to how I express it. It won't do me any good just to explode and have a rant or kick this person in the shins. This is not good. Or sulk. That's not going to work. But the feeling is there, but verbal violence isn't gonna help. So if I can't do anything else, okay, well, I'll experience it and I'll just be like a block of wood. I mean, it might be one way to do it. Okay, I'm experiencing it, but at least I'm not going to let it out. Or if we've got a little bit more control, we could experience it and try to express it in some skillful way, saying, actually, I'm feeling a little angry with you. I'm sure that's just as much my problem as it is yours. But so it's about feeling it, but not doing what the feeling is necessarily pushing us towards. There's a book, and I don't know if it's any good, this book, but the title brings the principle across. The book is called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. Yeah, I don't know whether it's a good book, but it is a good book. It is a good book, or quite a good book. But it's like that with anything. Feel the anger and do something else anyway. Feel it, but you don't have to do it. But you do have to feel it. Because if you don't feel it, you're getting into this repression area of denying, being ruled by it unconsciously, it coming up in all sorts of other ways, it poisoning the whole inner world. So it's feel it, but be creative. Not denying it or giving into it. Not denying it on the one hand, giving into it. And of course, I mean, we call this being in the gap, don't we? Anyone who's been to an introductory course here, this is what's meant by being in the gap. The world pushes our buttons in some way. Intense feeling, we usually do one particular thing which takes us around in a circle, or we can sit with the discomfort of not doing that and do something new, do something creative. So we don't just respond automatically. We use some creativity. Which incidentally also brings across a little bit about why some of these harder qualities are needed. Because it's actually very uncomfortable to be in the gap. What we usually do is we run from our dissatisfaction. We haven't got the courage to face our dissatisfaction, our discomfort, our pain, so we distract ourselves from it. We reach for the beer or the biscuits or the TV remote control, get me out of here, get me out of my experience, or we blame somebody or we get angry. It's about doing away with our discomfort, whereas being in the gap or doing the feel it and do it anyway involves actually being aware of what's going on and putting up with the discomfort. That actually takes a bit of robustness and courage. So an awful lot of the spiritual life really is about having the courage. Well, it's about a sort of courageous approach to dissatisfaction rather than a running away from it type approach. So in order to be patient and gentle, we need to be able to tough out discomfort, not seek a sort of soft, cozy feeling all the time. So we're seeking to be in the gap. That's the sort of shorthand we use, being in the gap. And one opposite to being in the gap is just to give in to our usual reactions. Snap back when somebody annoys us. Sulk. Reach for the beer, reach for the biscuit, whatever. And the other opposite is to repress, push down. I'm not angry. I'm a Buddhist. Don't do anger. And actually, maybe it's better. If those are the two options, we could argue all night about which is better. Is it better, if it's something destructive like anger, to repress it? If we can't be in the gap, is it better to repress it, or is it better to express it? The sort of message that we get probably from sort of humanistic psychology is express it, express it. But then that can be very destructive. And then repressing it can be very destructive as well. Maybe it is better to try and express our feelings in some way, in creative ways, even if we're a bit clumsy with it, than to sit on them, even with really destructive emotions like anger, even if we're sort of taking a few risks here. There's a verse from a poem by William Blake which says, I was angry with my friend, I told my wrath did end. I was angry with my foe, I told it not, my wrath did grow. So, I mean, maybe even if it's if it's clumsy, we have to make some attempt to express. That's better than going the other extreme, I think. But then I would, because I'm like that. But then other people might see it the other way. The point is that to become integrated, we need to not deny these coarser energies. Anger, greed, competitiveness, anxiety, fear, ambition. Stay aware of them as drives, but not give in to them. Respond creatively. And when we do this, we gradually become more at home with them and more able to use their energies in skillful ways. And as I said, the key to doing this is awareness. Stay aware of how we feel and how we respond. And the key to awareness is likely to be meditation. In the normal course of events, everything happens really fast, doesn't it? Sometimes it just seems to happen too fast for us to stay aware. We're aware of how we responded about, three responses ago. It's a bit as though we've been whitewater canoeing and we've capsized and we're just being bundled along by events and our mental states and we don't know which way is up. And every now and then we get our head above water and take a look round. But generally it's all sort of happening a bit too fast. That can be how we can experience life, I think. But meditation seems to slow all that down. It gives us a chance to practice being with our thoughts and emotions, letting them happen, but not identifying with them. It gives us that chance to slow it down, be with them, not quite so bundled along by them, not so pushed around by them. It's a bit as though we've got somewhere to stand in this stream. We can get out on a rock and sort of take our time a bit. So that's one effect of meditation, but the effects of meditation go a lot beyond that. They go a lot beyond that. If we practice it sort of authentically and courageously and well, what happens is we gradually learn to feel our feelings but not identify with them. We change our perspective. So we don't think, I'm angry. We don't experience it, I'm angry. We experience it more as, well, there is anger. There is an angry thought. There is an angry emotion. Part of the mental weather I'm subject to is anger at the moment. I don't have to think that this anger is me. I am angry. It's mental weather that I'm experiencing. And the more we learn to feel our feelings like that, in that way, but not identify with them, have a bit of distance on them, but not identify with them, the more we can disentangle the energy that's tied up with them as well. And maybe disentangle them from the unskillful volitions that go along with them. So in the case, for example, of anger, maybe we learn to experience anger, but let the ill will and self-justification and resentment, let that sort of dissolve. So that what we're left with is just the pure energy, just the pure bright energy of what we were experiencing. We're not angry. We've turned the energy of our natural aggression, if you like, into extra voltage for our being. It makes us brighter and hotter and warmer and more more alive. This is what I think Tibetan Buddhists sometimes refer to this as liberating negative emotions. So we liberate negative emotions. They talk about liberating them. We liberate a negative emotion by being aware of it. But we let it go. We let it go, but its energy is still there for us to use. So by not identifying with it, we let it go, but we've still got the energy of it. It's a bit as though our awareness is a magic wand. The awareness in our meditation is this magic wand. And there's this sort of horrible thing. And we sort of touch it with our magic wand and it changes from a horrible thing to a really lovely thing that we can use. We just got the energy left and all the sort of blah of it is gone. So we turn it into sort of something lovely, or we turn it into electricity. Now, at this point, I have to say, this takes practice, and it takes time. It happens when we keep up a meditation practice for months, years, and doing the meditation practice with the sort of commitment that means that we don't just run away from our feelings or deny them. We have the courage and fortitude to sit with our feelings, putting up with some discomfort. Then we can begin to see our feelings as mental weather, begin to liberate the energy they contain. So I'm not sort of offering this as a panacea. It's not like, okay, well, meditate for 3 weeks. Why haven't I transformed all my energies? It's a practice. It takes time. But it does work. It does work. It is possible. It does work to actually liberate our negative feelings in that way. We can do that in meditation by being aware of them, by allowing ourselves to experience them, but at the same time working with them. We really can. So Sangha actually came up with this system of spiritual development, integration, positive emotions, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. And in the way he originally presented it, he had different practices that were specific for each one. And the practice that he specifically connected with integration was the mindfulness of breathing. So he saw the mindfulness of breathing as the practice for helping us to become more integrated. So it's not the only one, but it's an important one because it is the one that's perhaps most directly related to developing this quality of awareness that we need as our sort of magic wand to transform those coarse animal energies into something really beautiful. It's the way that we develop mindfulness or awareness and the way we can develop it in our meditation, and we can take it out into our life so that we become just much more aware of what's actually going on in our hearts, in our minds, so we're more at home with it. And it has the quality, doing the mindfulness of breathing, has this sort of quality of bringing our being together, uniting our being, which is precisely what we're talking about here with integration. I mean, in a way, meditation is all about this, and it's even brought out by the posture. I mean, the sort of traditional meditation posture: your legs knitted together, your arms together. You're very sort of self-contained. You don't have to sit like that, incidentally, but it's quite a powerful. It's quite a powerful symbol, isn't it? That cross-legged posture with the arms together. It's united. It's unified. It's like the body is unified. There's no loose ends. There's no bits hanging off. It's all in one piece. It's very grounded on the earth. And so in that posture, you know, if we imagine ourselves in an ideal meditation, in that posture, very, very knit together in our being, we're aware of our mind, we're aware of our heart. So we're aware of our mental and emotional weather, but not caught up with it. And then this gradually settles down. It gradually settles down. Because we're not getting caught up with it, we're not pouring new energy into this stuff. That's all that story, all that stuff gradually settles down until all the different currents of our being a bit sort of flow together. They start to run together in a unified stream without any conflict, which brings this sense of calm and joy that comes along with it. So we sit there with these different strands of our being sort of flowing along together, and we're aware of our body. That's one of the crucial things in meditation, isn't it? We're aware of our body, so we're integrated with our body. We're not separated our mental world from our body. We're at home with our physical being. Our mind and body become in harmony. There's something about focusing on the breath which just seems to put the mind and the body in harmony. And then when we're in that state, something else can start to happen as well. It might feel as though sort of, inspirations, there's thoughts coming from we don't know where. It's as though there's fresh currents starting to well up in our depths. We're quite still, but there's something welling up. And in fact, there's a traditional image. There's a number of traditional images for the meditative states, or different parts of the meditative states. But one of them is this calm, peaceful pond or lake, but that's being fed by a clear, cool, crystal underground spring that's just coming up. So it's not disturbing the water, but it's being fed by these new sources from the depths, this clarity from the depths, an underground spring. And it can start to feel a bit like that, as though something is welling up from our depths. We're dead calm, but something sort of wells up from our depths. So we get little inspirations. Suddenly we see things differently. Get inspirations, we get inspired thoughts. So we're more in touch with our depths, our inspiration. We start to be aware of our depths. So we can start to integrate our depths. We can make them part of our personality. We can build our lives more around the sort of deeper intuitions that we have. So we could use the analogy of depths, or we could use the analogy of heights. I mean, it's not like, you know, we're using analogies here. We could use the analogy of heights instead of depths. So when our mind is sort of quieted and unified, what's highest and best in us can start to speak to us. We've quietened down enough that it can start to speak to us, as though an angel comes and whispers in our ear, giving us really good advice. We discover the sort of source of sanity and wisdom in ourselves that we weren't aware of. And we can start to integrate that. We can start to build our lives and our priorities more around this wisdom and sanity, more around this inner voice. So over time, meditation has this powerful integrating effect, letting us liberate our negative emotions and use the energy tied up in them, letting us integrate and harmonize with our body, our mind and our body, and putting us in touch with our depths, our deep intuitive inspiration, so that they can guide us, putting us in touch with our heights, our sanity and wisdom, so that we can put that sanity and wisdom more at the center of our being. So integrating heights, depths, integrating sort of horizontally, that can be, over time, that is the result of meditating. And that's very much what this first stage is all about. And if we didn't do any of the other stages, that would be great, wouldn't it? Because in a way, it includes the other stages. You can't do it without the other stages. So this business, I talked about integrating heights and depths. I could illustrate that by another couple of mythic creatures from the Buddhist tradition. So one of the mythic creatures I'd like you to introduce you to are the creatures of the depths, the Nagas. The Nagas. So Nagas live in the depths. They live in the depths of the ocean, the depths of the lakes, or the depths of the caves under the world. They live in the depths. And they're sort of serpent-like beings. They're shapeshifters. They can be lots of things. They're a bit related to dragons. But they're serpents. Sometimes they're shown as sort of having long serpentine bodies and upper body of a beautiful man or a beautiful woman. So these Naga princesses appear, and they're very beautiful, but they're sort of got long, snaky bodies. Or Naga kings appear, and they're very sort of strong and noble, but again, they've got very... And when Nagas are in that form, they tend to have lots of like cobra heads that come out from behind their head and over them. So they've got this canopy, like a hat of cobra heads. Maybe they've got seven cobra heads spread out above their heads. So they're rather odd beings. So they can be just like serpents, or they can be half serpents, half humans, or sometimes they can just manifest as humans, which saves a lot of trouble, really. So they manifest also as humans. And I said they're a bit like dragons, didn't I? So dragons guard treasure. And traditionally, Nagas guard treasure. They've got loads of treasure. They've got gold and jewels and lovely stuff in the depths. So they're guarding, they're keeping the jewels of the depths, the treasures of the depths. And some of these treasures aren't necessarily just sort of diamonds and gold. They're sort of metaphorical diamonds and gold as well. They can be teachings. They can be wisdom, because the Nagas have got a sort of deep wisdom. They're sort of intuitive, deep wisdom. So, for example, the Nagas preserved the deep wisdom teachings of the Prajnaparamita. Humans weren't ready for them yet. So the Nagas, it was part of the Nagas' treasure, these deep wisdom teachings that they kept below the ocean. And then Nagarjuna, traditionally, Nagarjuna went to the realm of the Nagas. I don't know, how did he get there? Do you know? Anyway, maybe he had a big deep sea diving thing.
Jumps.
he went to the realm of the Nagas. He went to the realm of the Nagas, and the Nagas gave him these deep perfection of wisdom teachings so that he could bring them back for humanity. Well, of course, how did he get there? He meditated, didn't he? That's how you get to the depths. You meditate. You get access to the depths. And when you get access to the depths, you get access to the sort of deep intuitive wisdom of the Nagas, and you get access to the Nagas' treasure if you're really lucky. So Nagarjuna went to this deep Naga realm and retrieved these teachings and brought them back for humanity.